dancing in the apocalypse.
I gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sparkle, Neely, sparkle.
I know what some of your big city no bra wearing hairy legged women livers might say.
Welcome to another episode of Maximum Film. How you doing? It's episode 217. That's 217. And you know it's almost Halloween. I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up, we have the Christmas Zaddy himself, the critic with the best opinions on all things, Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
That's an iffy opinion and not a mine. Let's just be real clear about that. What's good is that my goddamn book came out, and so I just Woo! That's going to be my thing this week.
The
deal got made like 2 years ago. So you hit that moment where you think, is this like an elaborate prank? Did I dream this? But now that I'm like seeing people on Twitter holding them up in Barnes and Nobles, it's very exciting. It's a real honest to God book. I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies. I wrote it with the very funny guys from the Deck the Hallmark podcast. They review more than 100 Hallmark Christmas movies. But from the perspective of one guy who loves them, one guy who likes them, and one guy who despises them. So however you feel about Hallmark Christmas movies, somebody in this book has your back. And I think it's a really funny read all the way through. There's some great recipes in the back for, you know, entertaining. And I'm very proud of it. And I hope people pick it up.
Yay, ooh, we're so proud of you.
Oh, thanks.
You done so good, Alonzo. Look at you. You're growing up so fast.
Just holding it down, you know, doing good things. You know, we're very happy. All right, next up, we have the Queen of the Midwest herself. And in Midwest fashion, she'll try to deny it, but we all know it's true. Trey Clark, what's good?
Midwest fashion. I love this. I think me and Casey are the only people from the Midwest that you know. So it's really a lot of weight on these white-ass shoulders.
That's a pretty broad sampling, I think.
So I'm excited because, you know, Alonzo has his own book to be his What's Good. So I'm going to take the Alonzo stance and talk to you guys about something on Criterion Channel. Ooh. I'm really excited. The programming is so beautiful. And if you ever wonder why curation is important in art, Criterion Channel is a great place to learn that. And they have a series they're doing in November called Between Us Girls, Bonds Between Women.
Yes.
And so it's all films that are a wide-ranging portrait of female friendship and sisterhood, and looking at all the ways that women support each other. And these are like Just Another Girl on the IRT, Old Enough, Passion Fish, which I remember from a very formative time, to like Margot at the Wedding, Mustang, which is a recent international film that's so good. So if you are not... if you're like, oh, I don't watch old movies, so I don't get... No, this is a wide range of things. You can get a 14-day trial. It is film school in a bottle. Anyway, I'm just really excited about this programming. I think they do such beautiful stuff. That's what's good with me. Being free PR for another company.
You know, that's what we do here. You know, if you don't pay us, just wait. We might do it for free.
We might do it anyway.
We cheerlead the things we love.
So on this pod, we're known to have wonderful friends and illustrious guests, and this guest is no different. Honestly, at this point, we can say she's a fan favorite. Writer and host of the podcast, Austerian, Jordan Cruciola, what's good?
Hello, everybody. Jordan. I'm so glad to be back with the team, Maximum Film team. Yeah, it's just, it's always so fun to hang out with you guys. So thank you for having me back. I appreciate it. And I suppose I should answer the question of what's good.
Yes. And get to the point, Jordan.
Yeah, I don't know how long things stick around when they show up on the Criterion Channel, when they do the notes like coming in October. But they did program Jennifer's Body onto the Criterion Channel for October. Ooh. As I would imagine part of like genre oriented programming. And this I see, since you mentioned it, I might as well piggyback on that, Drea. This might come out after October. Who knows if it'll still be there. But I believe that this is, and my corner of Twitter has told me so, that this is thanks to me. This is because of me. I will accept that credit completely.
I fully assume at this point that you get back end points in Jennifer's body.
I'm gonna say that we've done it. We've almost done it, team. We're this close to getting that Criterion release of Jennifer's body we've been fighting so hard for. If anybody else writes the essay for it but me, I will come after you. That's a pledge right here and now. And then to not just double down on Criterion promotion.
I think Joe Esterhaas is writing that essay, actually.
if it's not going to be me, it should be a cis male. I know that for sure. Well,
I mean, if not you, Michael Bay himself.
Michael Bay. Me or Michael Bay. That's the coin toss for the Criterion essay for Jennifer's body. But my other what's going to be, and this will like... come like at this will come out or around the release of this episode, that show Yellow Jackets is coming to Showtime. That like I've been at once trying to like savor every second of a trailer that they put out but also read nothing. But it's I think the showrunner or creator is Ashley Lyle. The first episode is directed by Karin Kusama. It is about a high school sports team, girls sports team. I don't know what sport but I think their mascot is the Yellow Jackets. I think it's why it's called that. Their plane goes down in a remote location and they are like stranded in the wild. And we see like it's at once in the present timeline with grown actresses playing the women. And then in the old timeline from when they crash. And it gets so fucked up in the flashback. There's like scary, like it goes Lord of the Flies. There might be cannibalism. There might be murder. But like we jump into the present. It is Christina Ricci, Melanie fucking Lynskey, Juliette Lewis.
Oh, wow.
And it's all of them coming back together for some reason. And they're all like, do people know? Did someone tell? But we don't know what the thing is. They don't want anybody to know. But we know that it goes full, like, looks like demon pagan worship in the woods. I cannot wait. I cannot wait. I'm psyched.
If it was good.
Oh, man. Yes. You know, thanks for getting in early, Drea. I got to say, you know, this what's good with me. You know, this was bordering on a what's good and what's bad. What's good with me is I went into a haunted house, a claim to be haunted house. And you can imagine how that went for me. We went ghost hunting. We had all the devices. It was wild.
Willingly.
Yeah. But what
Jordan,
I will
do you
say,
know that he's a soft, sweet baby who can't handle horror?
Like, my exposure to it stops it to the screen. I will do nothing IRL three dimensional. No, not
Iffy,
I will
I'm
do a
shocked.
Corn maze. I no. Yeah. So I'm with Iffy. This is crazy.
I was shocked myself, but you know, towards the end, it got to the point where like there was enough evidence to be like, this place ain't haunted. I ain't got no ghost to worry about. To me, it was more fun than like a Monsters in Store haunted house, because the only person who was scaring me was myself. Much like the skeleton I have outside of my door dressed up as me, that when I forget about it and I step outside, I think it's someone and I scream. That's happened at least five times in this Halloween season. So
my favorite, from what you just told us, you open the door, scream at the skeleton you hung, and then you walk away going, I'm not scared. This is me. Just like talking to yourself down the hallway.
And the neighbors are all like X-ing out the October dates until that damn thing comes down.
Yeah, oh, I can't wait.
It's like
wait.
A personal challenge.
Has been freaking me out. But who knows? I might just throw a Santa hat on it and just keep it out
Do
there.
It.
It was fun once it got towards the end and I started getting real confident, because then I started taunting the ghost because nothing was that. Because I even did the Ouija board and the Ouija board was not moving. And I was even doing like the loosest holding to let, you know, some of that action, that fake action happen, and nothing was happening. So I was like, all right. Ain't no ghosts here, but there are a few. I live streamed it, so there are a few great moments of me just booking it. Like you, I know now. In any situation, I will be gone. Like my first, I was like, there was no fight. It was straight
off
up flight. Yeah,
off flight.
the puff of smoke and three lines.
Yeah. Literally that.
And then an iffy shaped hole in the wall.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, speaking of holes, let's talk about holes and necks, because today we're discussing Interview with a Vampire. Yes. Oh, yeah. And we're going to return to the Hall of Excellence to induct cinema's hottest vampire. And of course, as always, we'll have staff picks. But first, it's time for our new segment, It's time for our new segment, Itadic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a new segment and answer the question, Is This Important? Do I Care? But before we begin today, we just wanted to touch upon the tragic death of Halyna Hutchins on the set of Rust. We are horrified by this incident, but we are not discussing this as a regular segment today for a few reasons. First off, it's an incredibly sensitive and horrific situation, but also there's still so much more information that is yet to be revealed about the incident. So we'll discuss it at length at some point, and it's obviously incredibly important and we do care about it, but we didn't feel it was right to discuss it at length on the show at this time. So instead, we're talking about the fact that Kristen Stewart says that she's only made 5 really good films. Kristen Stewart is making the press rounds for her upcoming film Spencer about Princess Diana. In a recent interview with The Times, she was asked about how she picks the movies she's going to star in. Stewart said of the process that there is no quote-unquote magic formula. And so she's quoted as saying, it's a total crapshoot. I've probably made about 5 really good films out of 45 or 50 films. Ones that I go, wow, that person made a top to bottom beautiful piece of work. She highlighted her 2 movies with Oliver Assayas. Olivier Assayas, Clouds of Sils Maria, and Personal Shopper as ones that she liked. But she also elaborated on the other movies she worked on. She's quoted as saying, I've only regretted saying yes to a couple of films, and not because of the result, but because it wasn't fun. The worst is when you're in the middle of something and know that not only is it probably going to be a bad movie, but we're all bracing until the end. Is this important? Do you care?
I think I care, and it is important to an extent. There's a great film that Mark Rappaport made called From the Journals of Jean Seberg, and Jean Seberg was an actress who originally flopped in a film version of Saint Joan, but then became an icon in the 60s when she starred in Breathless, and you know had a tragic life. Actually, was played by Kristen Stewart.
Was played by Kristen Stewart in the movie Seberg.
But in Rappaport's film, it's this sort of like, you know, fake From Beyond the Grave look back at her life, and she's played by Mary Beth Hurt, and it's a great movie. But at one point she says, I was in a handful of great films, and I realize now that even that is a lot.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you know, this is to say that I've only made a handful of really good movies. It's not easy to make a really good movie. I would hope that people would take a more generous definition of what a good movie is than they tend to. Clay Keller, if you're listening, Charlie's Angels starring Kristen Stewart is a good and funny and enjoyable time.
Oh God, I love that movie.
Of cinema. And it's her gayest role, so take that, Clay.
Other than when she played in Still Alice, when she played...
Well, I guess there was Lizzie. There was Lizzie, and that is one of her really good movies.
Happiest Season, folks.
Happiest Season, yeah. The Olivier Assayas movies.
The
Messenger is an underrated horror film from the 2000s. Panic Room is a great film.
Underwater is silly, but it's entertaining.
Underwater... fucking rules. Underwater, what more could you want from an entrapped under the sea monster movie? Like, what is that movie not achieving that people could have asked from? It is wall to wall.
It does what it says on the box, for sure.
I think part of this is speaking to, she makes really bold choices and a wide range of choices.
Wide variety.
Like, she's, you know, it's part of that she started as a child actor. When you have Panic Room, if you have a Fincher film under your belt before you've cleared puberty, you're already kind of ahead of the game. But she's made really interesting choices for herself. And a lot of it is also the directors that she'll work with. Like, she did Certain Women. She did the J.T. Leroy movie, which isn't a great success. But I can completely see why Kristen Stewart could be drawn to the possibility of that. And a lot of people make much more, like, hedge their bets a lot more when they're choosing what projects they'll put their weight to.
She's a really good actress who became the most famous for the worst films she ever made. And I think since then, it's been this thing of having to convince people, no, I actually do know what I'm doing. I am really good at my job. But, you know, sadly, I think probably to this point, even her highest grossing films are the ones that are the least interesting and asked the least of her as a performer.
I mean, I don't know. Those movies asked a fucking lot. Those movies ask a lot to commit to being Bella Swan for 5 installments and same thing to being Edward for 5 installments. And I, like, people can rag on those movies as much as they want, but not many actors can say they were a part of something around which the entire landscape of pop culture bent for a period of time. And that is what fucking happened with the Twilight franchise. Like that in the way that like Titanic, people rag on it like it was a bad choice at the Oscars, it rearranged the film conversation for an entire year or more. And Twilight rearranged how we like what blockbusters were greenlit and like what the zenith of fandom for like horny women could be.
It's also forever going to be interesting that the actor that Kristen Stewart is most similar to for trajectory is Robert Pattinson.
True. That is in terms of fair point.
Sharing that spotlight and then the choices and then talent revealed after that, because that is the kind of project, like you say, that I could definitely see someone being like, yeah, I'm not into acting anymore. I'm an entertainment lawyer now. Like, so good for her. Good for her still taking these big swings.
I mean, Star Wars did not turn Mark Hamill into a megastar, you know, and I mean, it's like these really successful movies can be a double-edged sword. And I think that you're right. Both of them have made really interesting choices since then and have, I think, you know, for the most part, unless you are just fervently deciding not to pay any attention to anything, have silenced the naysayers because, you know, but to her point, I think that, there are few careers where people can say they made more than about five great movies. And if you have, good for you. But I mean, like, getting to five is an achievement.
And she's 31.
For a career that's in media res, also.
She's an infant.
But I feel like this happens with every, like, actor and actress, and that's the only like gripe I have for this is like when you get on and you're doing the cool artsy movies and you're starting to be in this Oscar contender, you're like, oh, those old movies. But it's like, but without Twilight, without you getting your price up with Twilight, you did not have the chance to pick and choose the movies. Without your Star Wars, Adam Driver's can't pick and choose the Annettes. So it's like it like I get the idea, especially because her two movies that she picked were by this director who I may have been edited out ruining his name, but it's like it's like you chose like it's
Olivier,
like when
Osayas,
it's like when you're like, who's your favorite rapper? Oh, you know, I like Immortal Technique. And it was like you chose the most highest of highbrows to be like, these were my good movies. It's like, relax.
But in her defense, this came up because someone asked, how do you pick the movies? And she was saying It's a crapshoot. Like, you don't know. You kind of go with your gut. And I think that she's expressed a decent amount of gratitude for what Twilight brought to her in terms of exposure.
I think
there's certainly other people that I'm like, okay, settle down. Enjoy your fucking house. Like,
I think it reveals also that she has a high standards for what she wants to get out there. You know, ask Tyrese how many good movies he's made. He'll tell you all of them, I'm sure.
I was going to say, I bet he would tell you all of them.
Yeah, I mean, as a matter of fact, we'll leave a space so Casey can add the sounds of his Django audition that he put together.
When I ring this bell, you better come a running. You. Nobody else.
That is, and this is my small tidbit and we'll move on. But as an actor, that is the funniest thing to me is when you get to see the like self-tapes that names get to put in, because fucking Tom Cruise will do a self-tape in the drive-thru of a Burger King. I was like, that's it. But then I get the email was like, you got to make sure there's no background, no sound, no nothing. I was like, bro, I saw Timothy Chalamet do it on a Tonka truck. And then y'all were like, yeah, this is the guy for Dune. Like, let me just not have a back. You can live with my TV in the background of this audition.
I love the world Iffy lives in, where Tom Cruise A, has to self-tape, and B, drives himself through
to a Burger King.
You know which way. Like, they'll find those old ones where it's like, this was the moment. This is when we knew.
This was
like,
the moment.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, okay. All right, cool. And with that, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking about Interview with a Vampire. So hold your fangs. We'll be right back.
Well, hello. I'm Renee Colvert.
Hi, I'm Alexis Preston, and we are the hosts of Can I Pet Your Dog?
And we got breaking news, we got an expose, and all the beans have been spilled via an Apple Podcast review that said, this show isn't well-researched. Well, yeah, no duh. Of course it's not. Not since the day we started has it been well-researched. Guessing and anthropomorphizing dogs is what we do.
The Can I Pet Your Dog promise is that we will never do more than 10 seconds of research before telling you excitedly about any dog we see.
I'm going to come at you with top 10 enthusiasm, minimal facts.
We're here for a good time, not an educated time.
So if you love dogs and you don't love research, well, you know what? Come on in to Can I Pet Your Dog podcast every Tuesday on Maximum Fun Network.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Effie Wadiway. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Jordan Cruciola.
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today we're talking about Interview with a Vampire. Alonzo, would you mind providing us with a brief synopsis?
I never look at this part of the script, and so it's just always a surprise when you say my name. Okay, sure. So it's the 90s, and it's a very 90s 90s. And Christian Slater is a journalist who meets up with a pale, elegant fellow played by Brad Pitt, who claims to be a vampire. And Christian Slater's like, yeah, sure. And begins the titular interview. That's where all the guys in the audience nudge their dates and go, that's the interview with the vampire. And Brad Pitt tells his tale of woe about having been a plantation owner in old Louisiana and lost his wife and child and was on the verge of offing himself when he winds up getting nibbled on by the vampire Lestat, played by Tom Cruise. And he basically spends most of the rest of the movie being a real whiny ass about how being a vampire means you have to kill people. And he's just not down for that, but he's going to do something because he's got to stay alive. In the meantime, they form a nuclear family with Kirsten Dunst, who steals the movie, frankly, as the young child, whom they also turn into a vampire who will be forever eight, because that's just the way things go. And eventually Dunst and Brad Pitt run off to Europe, where they meet the Theater of the Vampires, led by a nearly incomprehensible Antonio Banderas. And my parents were Spanish. So, you know, And things happen.
Yes. So let's kick this off with the first question that super producer Casey wrote. Can we really qualify this movie as a gay horror?
I think this movie is more gay than it is horror.
Yes.
But I would still say yes to both. When rewatching this, I'm assuming this is one we've all seen before. Mm. I mean, everyone knows famously Tom Cruise got this part because he did a self-tape in a drive-thru of a Burger King.
Yeah, this was the one I was referencing.
Yeah, this is the one Iffy was referring to. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Famously, Anne Rice was like, get me that Burger King. See? And, but
is the Burger King.
He is the Burger King.
Of the night.
But when I rewatched it with, like, you know, we're doing this month of queer horror and having that in my, oh my God, I was like, was I the dumbest human for most of my life? Because I think part of it was I was so horny for Christian Slater at this point that, like, I was just like, ooh, get back to the Christian Slater scenes. This is the gayest, and I say
this
that
movie is so gay,
but in a way that almost felt I was like, this movie is about a gay couple who puts together a family.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? It's not gay.
Yeah.
Like,
100%.
Oh, there's the subtext. It's, oh no, these two men have built their lives together and one of them is manipulative and it is not a healthy relationship.
This
but
is a marriage story. This is a marriage story with gay vampires.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. To say this movie has a gay subtext is to say that my tweets have a horny subtext, because it is... Be like, even when the other vampire gets involved and he's like, I want to steal you away, you're gonna be mine. He's like, no, I don't want y'all. I'm sad.
Wait, Alonzo is giving us a look, and I would love to hear from him.
So, okay, I was I was very queer in 1994 and very annoyed that this movie existed, because it felt to me like this is a movie that feels like it is feeling so bold for a Warner Brothers movie in 1994, because the guys will hold their looks for a while, you know? And I just thought, like, there is so much gayness just baked into the storytelling that the mm-hmm. that the movie is not wanting to address at sure. all. And I thought it would be, I thought my perspective 27 years later would be like, well, I see what they were going for now. No, I was immediately 27 again and like, oh, fuck this movie. You know?
I think you're exactly right. Like, this was WB's gay vampire movie, but it's coming at the same time as the new queer cinema surge is exactly. happening. So by contrast, it's certainly no Gregor Rocky film. It's certainly no Todd Haynes film.
Can you imagine?
Sorry. It is not Safe. It is not Poison. But as far as what that tier of cinema and that tier of emergent slash bona fide superstar did, like, gay as
hell. I think
hell.
Part of it is I would have very much enjoyed some sex scenes with Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise. Like, and I felt very much more. Very much more, you guys. Are we getting
sex scenes between Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise. So that's
up.
That's a little abadi-abadi-abadi-abadi-abadi.
Yeah. For me, it was, I'm totally with you, Alonzo. I think it's when I rewatched it, I expected it to be actually more subtext and less like, oh, this is just like a dramatic relationship story, and that felt like they cut the like sex scenes out of.
And it's not even that I necessarily needed actual sex scenes. Not that I would have said no, but you know, here's the thing. I think you have two central characters. You have like Lestat is pure id, pure sexuality, mm-hmm. pure pansexual, like taking all comers, devouring everything in his path, literally. Played by Tom Cruise. Then you have Lewis, who is deeply soulful and haunted and aching with tragedy. It's
a true 90s dream boy. And I fucking hate that archetype, and I was even for it with his Louis. Oh my God.
At centuries of the pain and anguish of his existence that must involve the destruction of others, even though to do so destroys him, but not to do so would literally destroy him.
Right.
So they got the and most cerebral actor.
And he is played by Brad Pitt. And it's like,
it's horribly miscast.
Y'all are real pretty, but neither of you guys can bring the thing.
No, each of these men is note perfect. Nothing different. Locked into the parts. That like whiny ass look on Brad Pitt's face the entire movie, he fucking sells it. Tom Cruise as a like, yes, this vampire, this Hollywood vampire is gay and in a relationship with this other A-lister, buying it.
Tom Cruise was better in this than I remembered, but Brad Pitt
this is
more
one of my favorite performances from each of them. I mean, of course, as you said, Alonzo, it was absolutely true that Kirsten Dunst steals this movie.
This movie does not have any energy until they sadly take the life of a young child. She is like, bop. Sit down, grown men. A little girl is talking.
I'll tell you, if Tom Cruise's energy as Lestat, the whole movie, had been like when he burst through the window of the burning mansion and says, oh, perfect.
Yes. Like, I
would, that level of bitch from him, start to finish, I would have been way more on board, I think.
I would have welcomed it.
I did think Tom Cruise had more, like, he was like, giving more of those layers and giving more, like, there were like moments of that I really liked. Brad Pitt was so, especially all of the interview stuff, I was like, oh my God, how long have you been alive? Learn how to put some blush on, man. Like, he was so flat, and so and that's how they start the movie. And I was like, I'm sure they tried to figure out, how do we re-edit this so that we don't begin Interview with the Vampire with the interview? Is there a way around that?
No, what? Flashbacks? Okay, well, I guess that's where we are then.
Yeah. It is, I had forgotten how culturally specific it was, like that they start in America. Like you said, he's a plantation owner, and there's a lot more sort of race elements of it. There's a few black women who are in this. Tandy Newton.
I had forgotten that she was in this.
And then I was like, this was like 4 years before she did Mission Impossible with Tom Cruise. What is happening? Whoa. And
She goes back to Tandyway now, by the way.
Tandyway. That's
yes.
right.
Yes.
So she has this very small, very beautiful performance. Indra Ove is another woman who's like sort of preyed upon by them. And it's this like operatic. The female performance in this they're so small. They're all given like just little moments to shine. And generally they have to show their breasts when they do it. But they're like,
well, it's corset season.
It is. It's corset season.
It's hard to get away. Hard to get away from.
Iffy, had you seen this before?
Of course not. No.
I'm wondering. Yeah.
Were you ever scared?
No, I wasn't scared. I felt like, you know, this definitely had scare potential, but luckily I was safe. I was marked safe.
So how did you respond to these two guys?
Oh like, yeah, no,
cause I'm assuming you're familiar with the theatrical arts of Mr. Thomas Cruise and Bradley
Pitt.
Oh
yeah. No, I definitely was getting the vibes, but I definitely could see Alonzo, like, I would definitely be like, just let him kiss or get out of my face. Like, stop with all the subtext. Stop with all this, you know, bouncing around. Like, let's get some kissing. Let's see some kissing.
Antonio Banderas, like, seriously, like, makes all these Almodovar movies where he, like, not just makes out with dudes, like, you know, closes the deal with dudes. And he comes to this country to make Interview with a Vampire in Philadelphia. And it's like, could we just have him, can't Antonio Banderas make out with a dude in an American movie? Come on.
Well, I think that, like,
you're like,
this,
come on, let's get it.
Everything that we're saying, I think, is instrumental to how this movie is a part of the queer horror tradition, in that in vampirism, which is such an inherently queer monster, like such a like pansexual consumption, consuming everything and sort of exists through time. At a certain point, you just get bored enough that I would imagine you become pansexual, even if you didn't start that way.
And you're recruiting.
And how like throughout the history of vampirism on screen, we've had male vampires that skirt along the issue of queerness, and it's heavily implied but rarely seen through. And then you get to the 1970s and you get the lesbian vampire boom, where we see a lot of explicit queerness coming through in vampire stories, but it's always women. Because yes, women, lesbian, sexual revolution, post-Stonewall, like that's all good stuff, but it's also still largely men making movies where they're filming female vampires for the delight of men. And yes, women and, you know, queer, straight alike can enjoy these things, but we take them and we claim them for ourselves, even if they're not necessarily made for us. And so then you come through the 80s and you get Jerry Dandridge and you have Fright Night, and he's presenting as queer to be a safe figure. He's like the neutered, almost GBF neighbor in this GBF movie, where but there's no closing of the deal between him and his male companion either. And so you get into and then you have The Hunger in the 80s too, where you have queer vampirism, but again, it's Catherine Deneuve and Susan Sarandon. David Bowie's there in the movie is queer, but he's not demonstrably. It's just a big queer maelstrom. So then you get into the 90s, where we are experiencing this queer cinema boom. We're coming in like post-AIDS, like not post-AIDS, like deeply in the threat of AIDS activism and ACT UP and new queer cinema and reimagining like the hero and anti-hero on screen and Gus Van Sant films. But then you have this movie still that shows us how far we are yet willing to go, even in the 90s, surrounded by this incredible rising crop of queer cinema, even how chaste and neutered it still must be, and mm-hmm. how much men are still and their physical affection off limits in mainstream cinema compared to Sharon Stone is stabbing men to death and making out with women in Basic Instinct. And we have the erotic thriller surge that's happening in the 90s too. But hey, we can't have these two dudes kissing because that would be fucked up and too crazy. So it's all got to be read between the lines. So it's a very important text in that context of the queer horror conversation.
Thank you, Jordan. You've encapsulated everything, because if this movie weren't based on a mammoth bestseller that had sold in a big deal to the movies and weren't being produced by Warner Brothers, by David Geffen, thanks for nothing, homo man.
sure.
You know, like this is, I think, yeah, if this had been made by Killer Films, we'd be looking at a very different kind of film. But for where the studios were in 1994, fuck, for where the studios are in 2021, who are we kidding? You know, this is what we get. This is, we're still tiptoeing around, but even the tiptoeing is a lot further than we'd been before, because you're right, up until then, it had all been like lesbian vampires go, because straight guys love watching that.
But
heaven forbid a straight dude get a boner watching two like really super hot male vampires, you know, circle around each other.
And the threat is that they totally would, which is why we can't test that theory.
Iffy, are you so pissed that Jordan just said everything you wanted to say?
That was going to slide right out of my mouth, especially when we talked about the boom.
I'm sorry, Iffy.
I have all this film history I want to lay out.
I was going to mention that. That was my factoid, you know?
I know. I'm sorry, man.
We have to emphasize that horror by its nature is inherently queer.
Sure.
Horror is queer. Dracula was written by Bram Stoker. Like this, he wrote thirsty letters to Walt Whitman, they must meet, and his admiration for him. Have somebody live read those letters on this pod sometimes.
Speaking of hot picks, Bram Stoker could get it.
This is what I'm like. You look at Gothic literature, and you have Oscar Wilde, you have Bram Stoker, you have Mary Shelley, you have the forefathers and foremothers of this genre that are all queer, living queer lives. Oscar Wilde was out and queer and was prosecuted for it at the time, around the time that Bram Stoker wrote Dracula. So like, this is a genre that in its marrow and at its cellular level is queer by nature. And it's unfortunate that we watch something like a mainstream adaptation of Interview. You have to water it down, and that it can't be like a strand releasing version of Interview with the Vampire. Like Gus Van Sant's Interview with the Vampire in 1994. I would love if we could all universe that and like pull it out of the memory box and give that to ourselves. I would love it.
So right after you get in the time travel device and kill Hitler, your second thing is to greenlight Interview with a Vampire with Gus Van Sant in 94.
Which is a good way to segue into giving our final reviews of Interview with a Vampire. Jordan, because you're esteemed guest, fan favorite, loved by everyone in this Zoom. Why don't you go first?
I think I accidentally gave what my review would be for it, and its place in queer horror history. And it still works for me. Movie still works for me. The performance has still worked for me. It's one of those things like I want Gen Z people to watch, and then me to ask them about it and be like, so what does this mean to you? Because like I would imagine they'd be like, this is some weak ass shit. Like let's get to the getting. Like what? Like but I want to know like how the like pull your collar texts from the olden times hit the teens these days. I would love to know.
I refute that. I think I don't want Gen Z watching anything I used to watch because they find new ways to be mad about shit because they don't take time to take in the themes and they only watch it through the lens that they understand things in. You know. All right. Let's keep it rolling.
I would say stream it. I would do, if everything was the same and then they included some sex scenes,
stream it.
I would say screen it. But because they don't give me that hot action that I crave, I'm saying stream it. I did enjoy watching this, and I had more of appreciation for it as a relationship drama this time around. Not just me wondering when they'd get back to Christian Slater in his little vest in the role that was also meant to be played by River Phoenix, who also would have looked adorable in that vest. But yeah, so that's where I land.
Yeah, I stream it. Yes, agreed.
Yeah, I'm a stream it mainly for Kirsten Dunst's performance. Like, it's
so good.
You have to wonder, did she even understand that she was stealing the movie from these like major movie stars? I was just on the Christmas Clatter podcast, and we interviewed Carolyn Grimes, who played Zuzu in It's a Wonderful Life, who is still with us at 80 and like smart and funny and has amazing recall of all this stuff. And she had no idea who Jimmy Stewart was. Like, like, she said her parents were not like super into movies or anything. So even though she worked as a kid actor, he was just this guy that she was doing a movie with. So it was, you know, so she, there wasn't this awe of like, oh, I'm doing a scene with Jimmy Stewart. It's like, no, okay, he's my scene partner. Great. And so I don't know what Kirsten Dunst's knowledge or thoughts about Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise was, but she was like, I got this. Yeah, so yeah,
I don't see anybody but here but me. I'm the only one in this room. Exactly.
If you ever wonder what star power is, it is what what's old Kiki's bringing.
When are you interviewing me? I'm the vampire here, right?
Yeah. Aren't I? And I'll interview myself. Thank you. It's also very famously was her first on-screen kiss, and she's 12 because she kisses Brad Pitt. And God, she always was asked about it in interviews, and she was like, it's disgusting. I was 12. He's like an old 12. Man.
But beyond that, to me, this is one of those movies, like, there's a film called These Three, which was the first screen adaptation of Lillian Hellman's The Children's Hour, and they take the lesbianism out of it, and they make it a movie about a conventional love triangle, because it was made in, like, the 30s or 40s, and, you know, just that wouldn't fly. So, in a way that movie is historically interesting for everything that's not in it, Interview with a Vampire.
Yep.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm a team stream it, too. And, you know, everyone gave good reasons for why you should check this out. I'm going to give you one that's not as good, but it's personal to me. You know, when you watch the old, like, you know, the old black and white films of yesteryear, and it has that kind of like that Vaseline effect that we don't use as much. I was noticing watching this that there is a 90s fuzz on like, there is a specific 90s fuzz, and it hits a nostalgia thread in my body that goes down my spine and pleases me. So
it's a visual ASMR.
Yeah, this film has that in, and it is really great because it is like, I do feel like as cinema progresses, there's just going to be one thing from each generation visually that will let you know.
Make it a Blockbuster night.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, it's just truly.
Yeah, you were a horror fan in the 2000s. It was Chartreuse. Fucking everything.
Oh, man. That was my review. So I'm going to just take a straight break. I'm slowly unraveling. So I do need a second take a sip of water and come back. But when we do, we got some more show for you. So we'll be right back after a short break.
Are you riddled with guilt over your TBR pile?
Are you filled with shame about a book that you just can't seem to finish?
Are you having regrets because grad school killed your love of reading?
We're Reading Glasses, and we're here to help.
I'm Mallory.
And I'm Bria.
Let us absolve you of all your reading guilt.
Stuck on a book you don't like?
We'll help you dump it.
Can't figure out what to read next?
We'll recommend something in your wheelhouse.
Can't decide where to buy your books from?
We'll point you in the right direction.
No matter what you read or how you read it,
we'll help you do it better.
Reading Glasses, every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Evie Wideway. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duralde,
Jordan Cruciola,
Drea Clark.
And it's time to return to our Hall of Excellence. This is a place where we honor excellence in film. We have four individuals currently in the hall. Adam Driver, Dame Helen Mirren, Betty Gabriel for her performance in Get Out, and Gary Oldman's asshead wig from Bram Stoker's Dracula. And this week, we will add another. Inspired by Interview with a Vampire, the category under which we are placing an individual in the hall this week is cinema's hottest vampire. Alonzo, Drea, Jordan, and I will each submit a nominee and make our case before the Grand Meister of the Hall of Excellence, producer Casey. We will then vote and decide who gets in. Alonzo, please begin. Who or what is your nominee?
Okay, I know mine's not going to get picked this week. I'm going to say that up front because it's not even really cinematic. I think technically it was for British television or something, but Louis Jourdan played Dracula in what I think is a really great adaptation. Louis Jourdan up to that point had been, you know, he's the guy from Gigi. Like, he was a musicals guy. He was in Hitchcock's, I want to say, The Paradine Case. Like, just he was in Swamp Thing. Like, you've seen him in a million things. But his Dracula, and I don't know if it was that perfect match point of, like, me finally getting old enough to understand what's even sexual about Dracula in the first place. Because, you know, as a kid, like, oh, he bites women in the neck. I don't see what, okay, whatever, you know. And also the way that Jordan plays it, because he has a scene where he comes into a woman's bedroom, wakes her up, but not the man sleeping next to her. And to, you know, he's already like bitten her once and she's ready to feed. So he takes his fingernail and does this slash across his bare chest. And she just starts lapping at it. And I'm like, oh, I get it now.
Wow.
So that, woo, to me, is always going to be the sexiest vampire. No, nobody who followed ever really could come close to that. But not a lot of people have seen that version. And I'm sure y'all have, you know, better suggestions. So go for it. But that's what I got.
I really, I'm going to read this as just like very shrewd political play on Alonzo's part. Like, oh, you know, don't even worry about my, you're not going to pick it. I mean, it's just like so formative and it sounds really impressive and European and old. So like, you guys should know it, but I love it. I do have mine. I was very excited about this. And from my heart, I feel very convinced this is cinema's hottest vampire, and that is, in the role of Akasha, Aaliyah as the Queen of the Damned.
Also by Anne Rice.
Lestat is in the film, is played by
Stuart Townsend.
I was like, Mr. Eyebrows dated Charlize Theron. Yes.
In a Hallmark movie this year.
You know, where we all end up eventually. Except for Charlize Theron. Aaliyah, obviously mega talent. Queen of the Damned came out like after she passed away. It's sort of in this, she passed away in 2001. It came out right after in 2002. She was the Queen of the Damned. She had this, I mean, she's just a visual, like, obviously began as a pop star, was moving her way into acting roles. Obviously, we've discussed, I don't even want to say Romeo Must Die, because Iffy is, like, obligated to give the rant, but just rewind to a previous app, and you will hear his thoughts on that. But she had incredible star power and was so hot. And that we have qualified this as hottest vampire. She has this like Egyptian style headdress and this low slung thing, abs of a goddess. And then not even like, it's sort of like a welded titty cup. Like it's not even a full bra. Like, I think it's just like, it's like Zendaya's recent Tom Ford melded stuff is like, oh, that looks so puritanical. Let us show you these pictures of Aaliyah as Queen of the Damned. Like, she was just...
Allow us.
Allow us. She was just so sexy and vibrant, even in the ridiculous writhing of that movie. And I love her. And she wore these stupid contacts. And again, the headdress. Oh, Aaliyah. Rock the boat. Oh, heartbreak forever. So both a titillation and a bummer. You guys are welcome.
That's a great combo right there.
Jordan, who do you have?
It's tough because like hot. Oh, what is a hot? Like, so I am a big sucker for Peta Wilson, but her part is so small in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. But her, like that her as Mina Harker, like really did a lot for me, but it's like such a small part. And like objectively, like who is the vampire I most attract? Wesley Snipes as Blade.
Oh my god!
Wesley Snipes as Blade
to
is
live in Jordan's brain. Just
Jesus God, the muscles, the utility clothing,
the
lined up hair, the everything. How do you make some of those lines he said just badass and not crazy? Like, some motherfucker just always trying to ice skate uphill.
Some motherfuckers are always trying to ice skate uphill.
You can say that and be cool. Like, you're fucking untouchable. It is a dead heat for me between Wesley Snipes Blade and then Eva Green as Angelique in Dark Shadows.
Because that's a good call.
Maybe no one could be hotter than Eva Green, period.
Truly.
And like, she is like, when Eva Green decides to go into that mode, she is just the personification of sex and seduction and sultriness. And that movie is bad. I don't care for it. Not even in like a fun and silly sense. Like it just doesn't do much for me, but I will just like, give me the YouTube cut. That's just all the minutes of Eva Green as Angelique. So it's either Angelique or it's Blade for me.
We're gonna have to pick one because we're gonna have to vote.
Fuck.
Yeah, I know.
All right, I'm gonna go with Angelique because I think she adheres more to the notion of hotness for like sexiness as people here might consider it. I not to take anything away from Wesley and the incredible hotness of Wesley Snipes, but I will go with seductress Angelique in Eva Green.
Okay, Iffy. This is your genre, right?
Yeah, and it's hotness. Truly unprecedented because I think of the first time in Hall of Excellence history, we got a double nomination because it was a no-brainer that I was going to pick Aaliyah from Queen of the Damned.
No way, for real?
Yes,
excellent,
hands
excellent
down.
Choice. Excellent choice.
It was a moment in time when that came out. It rocked the world. She rocked the world. Mm-hmm. She still rocks the world posthumously. That was a guarantee.
I'll give you Aaliyah, and I'll just put in there, so to balance it out, Jemaine Clement in What We Do in the Shadows.
That is a specific kind of sexy that appeals to a lot of people.
That's
well worth the shout out.
A real just dirty guy. Can't fight that power.
Okay, Grandmaster here. Now it is time to vote. So each of you must vote for two nominees that are not your own. You cannot pick one of your own. So each of you must vote for two. Cannot be your own. Drea, we're going to start with you. Who are your two votes go to?
They're the ladies. I mean,
the ladies.
Aaliyah for obvious reasons and Eva Green for obvious reasons. Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Jordan, what are your two votes?
I'm going to go with Aaliyah. And then I will mess up the pronunciation of Alonzo's pick, but Jemaine is not my brand, so I can't go with, but like, I respect that. And like, know that that is very much a brand. And I think that is a crucial shout out in this, like that version of hot vampire, which is underrepresented. So
the loins want what the loins want. I get it. Yeah. I get it. Yeah.
Alonzo, what are your two votes?
Aaliyah for sure. And I'm going to say Jemaine, mainly just because, like, yes, Eva Green is you know, smoking, but Dark Shadows is one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life. And
you're an anti-Dark Shadows.
I cannot throw it a freaking bone
that's
here.
Great.
So.
No, I think that's an excellent position to take. Everybody in it did everything else they've done is better. Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, but no shade on Eva Green. She is, you know. But yeah, I'll go Aaliyah and Jemaine.
Iffy,
you know it's going to Eva Green first. I'll give it to Eva Green and the What We Do in the Shadows. Jemaine, and What We Do in the Shadows.
Very good. It's a very clear choice. Who is the hottest vampire in cinema? It's Aaliyah from Queen of the Damned.
That is legit.
I feel connected.
She is now entered into the Hall of Excellence.
Yeah.
I think that feels like a bipartisan selection. Like that feels like if you put that on Twitter, you're never gonna get full consensus on Twitter, but I think the ratio would lean heavily on people being like, okay. This is a divisive question, but what you're saying is the broadest common denominator option. Yes. Yeah.
People reached across the aisle for this.
they believe in Aaliyah's hotness more than they believe in paid leave for parents. So that is definitely true. Joe Manchin would support Aaliyh for sexiest vampire.
Yeah, and he makes all the bad decisions. So, you know, that lets you know. Well, that ends our discussion of all things Halloween for this year, which also means it's time to usher in a new season. It's everyone's favorite time of year. It's the Christmas Zaddy Christmas Movie Minute. As we all know, Alonzo gets 1 minute to discuss every Christmas movie that he saw this past week. Alonzo, are you ready?
Oh, woo-hoo! I'm ready. I've been ready.
All right. Well, once the music starts, you can start ripping and rolling. Casey, you ready? He's giving me the thumbs up, so let it rip.
Okay. So it's opening weekend. We only got the four films from Hallmark, but that was plenty to talk about. Me, You, and the Christmas Trees. Danica McKellar, who has since decided to quit and go to GAC, but it's the most relaxed she's been in a movie for ages. Maybe it's because she knew they were broken up. But she was really fun to watch, and she has not been in a long time. Boyfriends of Christmas Past, tons of Asian representation, including the smoking hot Raymond Ablack. The heroine doesn't quite make sense, but really attractive cast and some fun stuff. Christmas in My Heart. I loved Luke McFarlane. Never believed him as a country singer, but at least you get an amazing scene where Cheryl Lee Ralph and a young black woman talk about hair, which you've never seen on Hallmark before. And then finally, The Santa Stakeout, interracial couple, cop capers, shenanigans, pretty funny. It worked. And you got Joey Pantoliano on top of everything else. So off to a good start, Hallmark. Soon we'll be getting Lifetime and Up and theatrical releases and all the other stuff. So the movie minutes are going to get a lot more frenzied than this one. So everybody, buckle up.
Boom. And there you have it. It was so good, and I love it. Does sound like it's off to a great start. Let's see how diverse we can get, y'all. All right, but you know, for those getting into the season, buckling up, Alonzo, you got some kind of new book that people can read?
A perchance. Funny, it's been a few minutes since What's Good.
Yeah, I know. Top of the show seems like a million years ago. Yes, once again, the book is called I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies. I'm the co-author with Brandon Gray, Daniel Pandoff, Daniel Thompson, the host of the Deck the Hallmark podcast. It's a lot of fun, and it's available wherever books are sold. Get one.
Yay, Alonzo.
All right.
So now it's time for staff picks. It can be any movie at all. Alonzo, you know, you're already talking. Why don't you start?
Well, you know, we didn't really talk much about director Neil Jordan when we were discussing Interview with the Vampire. And, you know, I think that he is one of those filmmakers who generally is most interesting. The smaller scale his productions are, the more sort of personal and independent that they can be. So I'm going to recommend his 1984 The Company of Wolves, which is, if you want a movie that deals in horror tropes and sexuality, this is your movie. Oh, and you would like some Angela Lansbury on top of that? Got her. This movie is terrific. He talked once in an interview about how he had a production design team that could afford one tree for a little Red Riding Hood movie, and they just kept shooting it at different angles. And then he said that that entire crew got hired to build a forest for Legend, but then it burned down halfway through shooting, so you know, go figure. Anyway, Company of Wolves, great movie. Beware of the men whose eyebrows meet in the middle. It is streaming on our favorites, Canopy and Tubi.
Tubi.
Or not.
Oh, okay. You said it faster than me. So, Drea, why don't you go? Since you so fast at talking, why don't you go next?
All right. So, I have a new release that is out in theaters this weekend. It is a sequel of sorts. It's The Souvenir Part 2 by Joanna Hogg. If you saw the first one, can be a difficult watch for anyone with addiction things, but it is the semi-autobiographical story of a young woman who falls in love with an older man who turns out to be a heroin addict. The Souvenir Part 2, which is just coming out, is fantastic and even better. The young woman, it's the continuation of the first. It's played by Tilda Swinton's daughter, Honor Swinton Byrne, and Tilda plays her mother in it. And now it has an even more meta element because it's her trying to make a film based on what she went through with this relationship. So it's smart and introspective, and it's funnier than the first one. Anyway, I think it's a great watch, and even if you didn't see the first one, you are totally fine. It brings you up to speed right away. Yeah, great little female filmmaker film out there if you want to go support and enjoy.
Support and enjoy. Well, let's support and enjoy Jordan. What you got for us?
I have been talking about this movie so much lately because the churn of streaming, just things get lost so quickly. And if you, world, have missed the erotic thriller the way I miss the erotic thriller, speaking of like the fuzzy 90s, the absolute zenith of it, there is an erotic thriller that came out recently on Amazon Prime. It is called The Boyers. And if you know me, you may have saw me feverishly tweeting my way through this. And I think the two biggest endorsements I can say about this movie are, one, it is so 90s in its erotic thriller absurdity. And two, the director, writer-director Michael Moen, he like caught that my live tweet was happening. And the very first tweet at the top says, I'm about to watch The Voyeurs. This movie better be trash. Like, I'm like begging for trash. And he retweeted that.
No.
So he was like, this girl wants to see some fucking trash. Tune into this thread, everybody. And if you are a director of an erotic thriller in 2021 that can feel extremely 90s and you are hyped about someone telling people that they are going to watch your trash movie and it delivers, I want to pair this in a double with The Perfection. That's how much this movie keeps raising the stakes on itself.
Yes.
Yeah. That is how much this movie just decides to let the wheels come off. Trash. This movie is glorious trash. It is sexy. There is lots of sex if that's your thing. And it feels sleazy in that way that you want to see that doesn't feel like you need to apologize for it after. So get you some Voyeurs and have a ball.
Okay.
If your thing is horny tweets, Iffy, I highly recommend this movie.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, Iffy can't even say his staff pick now because he's too busy looking up The Voyeurs.
Yeah, I know. You know, I watched 365 Dini, so you know I'm about to jump right into this. You know, I'm about to jump right into it, like dripping out. Yeah, you know, if you're all feeling vamped up from this movie, I want to keep you vamped up. So that's why I went ahead and, you know, went ahead and I chose this masterpiece from 2003, directed by Len Wiseman. That is the Underworld movie and thus series. Kate Beckinsale knocking it out the park.
I almost picked Kate Beckinsale earlier. I almost picked Kate Beckinsale.
Yeah, I know. It was so close. And that would have been a lot harder for me, you know? But yeah, The Underworld, the first one is so solid. I truly enjoyed it. If you were someone who was jamming out to the Daredevil Evanescence music video, you need to watch this movie. Okay.
Can we just say that our queer horror series officially ended when Alonzo's body or soul just left his body with you saying this movie? Because that was the epitome of queer horror.
Well, the gift of hotness that is Underworld is that even when you don't have Kate Beckinsale because it's the prequel Underworld Rise of the Lycans, you get Rona Mitra.
Yeah, yeah.
Who could also be in competition for hottest vampire of all time. God damn.
We coming at you with the hits. Only the hits. Alonzo agrees.
I think I might rather watch Dark Shadows again than any of the Underworld movies.
Well, you know.
It could go either way. I'm just saying.
Eva Green will be waiting for you at the very least.
Oh my gosh. Well, that's all we have today. So thank you so much, Jordan, for being on the show. Is there anything you'd like to plug before, you know, we get up out of here?
As always, you can tune into the Oxterion podcast where me and my co-host Sam Weidman are giving the Criterion level deep dive treatment to horror movies from the 2000s, talking 2000s millennium era and talking about where they intersect with the pop culture climate of the time. And there's also, of course, the Disaster Girls podcast that I do with my co-host Amanda Smith. And then there's the Whole Movie podcast that I do where you can listen to back seasons talking about A Simple Favor, going deep on that, and also The Neon Demon. Ooh. So you can listen to hours of me talking.
Man, those are so many podcasts. It'd be wild if you had another one coming out.
It would be so crazy.
Be so
could you even imagine?
Dare?
I know.
Who
if you
would
had
dare?
One, that would be, well, who could prepare for such a thing?
How can I ask people to prepare for such a thing?
Yeah,
it's just so much of me talking.
I don't know. Well, if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at @maximum_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/maximumfilm or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien, secretly a werewolf. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson, openly a vampire. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.